Your great-grandfather was John D. Rockefeller, who created the powerful Standard Oil Company of the late 1800s. Place yourself in the next generations of your family that came after him.
He had a son, John D. Rockefeller Jr., who devoted his life to giving away much of the money that his father had made. And then his children, he had six children, the youngest of whom was my father, David Rockefeller. And there were 22 first cousins out of the first litters. And there were two more after me, but I was the youngest of the first wave of cousins. And I'm the youngest woman of the cousins' generation.
And you grew up in New York and in Maine, and then you lived in California after you got married.
Yes.
How did you come to Vermont?
Well, first, because I came to Middlebury College and had a wonderful 4 years there. And I wanted to return to New England after having gone to a wonderful boarding school, seventh and eighth grade, across Lake Champlain, near Lake Placid, called North Country School. So I was determined once I finished out boarding school in Maryland that I was coming back north and Vermont was it. And then after I graduated, about 4 years later, I returned looking for a weaving studio, which I found at Shelburne Farms, which then was only just beginning their programs. And while I was there to do weaving, I kept hearing about these educational programs starting, and before long, I just couldn't contain myself, and I helped to start the education programs with the woman they'd hired. Then the following year, I became their first director of development and communications. So that's really how I got to Vermont. While working at Shelburne Farms, I met what was to become my husband of now 33 years, Paul Growald. And yet he was living in San Francisco, asked me to move out there. I moved there on Halloween, which is probably the best possible day to ever move to San Francisco because it's one huge party. So it was just wonderful. We spent 17 years there, and amazingly, we've now been back here full-time 17 years.
Your family's name is filled with history and politics and extreme wealth and philanthropy. And your feelings about being a Rockefeller at different points in your life seem to range from extreme self-consciousness to gratitude to ambivalence at points. And I'd love to hear you reflect on what kind of responsibility you felt being a Rockefeller.
Well, I think one way to sum it up is if you go to Rockefeller Center and you look at my grandfather's credo, engraved in stone is part of the credo that I remember and have always remembered is every opportunity implies an obligation, every possession a duty, every right a responsibility. And that's a heavy mantle. And the fact that it was carved in stone at Rockefeller Center, my parents didn't really need to say that as a mantra. We all kind of found our way there and went, ugh, so what am I going to do that's going to live up to a life of philanthropy with far more money than the next generation has? How can I make a difference? But isn't that everyone's quest in life? No matter what family you come from, we all seek to find ourselves and to become ourselves. So I did go through a period early on of hiding from my name, trying to be normal. My mother had grown up in a middle-class background, and from her middle-class background, she had said to us, as a Rockefeller, you get double praise or double blame. So be sure you choose correctly. And oh, so going to school, we were driven in a chauffeured limousine. We would hop out two blocks before and nonchalantly walk to school like everyone else, in quotations. The effort to be like everyone else is again a universal. It's about belonging, and everybody wants to belong. So if you're too far to the left or the right, or you're too showy, too opulent, too whatever, it's a challenge to belong. In my 20s, I tried changing my name to McGrath, which was my middle name, my mother's name, and that worked fine for a while. They probably had already known. And that was the problem, is if you go incognito, then you never know. Who knows my name? And really, that doesn't matter. I just want them to know me. So I kicked the McGrath name out, much to my father's pleasure, because he preferred I have the name I was given. And so little by little, I guess really the writing of this book was about self-healing and about becoming myself.
You mentioned your mother just now, and she seemed like a force of nature.
You can say that again.
And interestingly, she married into the Rockefeller family, but I got the impression from reading your book that she was also really kind of the standard bearer of making sure your generation, her children, upheld the Rockefeller tradition and expectations.
I think that's true. She cared desperately that we upheld a standard, whether that was the Rockefeller standard or her own standard, or it simply happened to mesh with my father's. She cared deeply, as does my father, who's 99 and still driving a pair of horses. She cared deeply that we never assume anything from others, and that we treat a taxi driver or a hotel house cleaner the same as we would treat a king or a head of state. And I really admire that quality in my parents. You know, to this day, it doesn't matter who my father meets. He always extends his hand and says, "Hello, I'm David Rockefeller. So nice to meet you." And he means it.
You are the youngest of six siblings. Mm-hmm. And you kind of grew up with some sharp feelings of being an outsider among your siblings. Describe how that shaped how you developed as a person.
It has shaped me very much so. I think, as is true for all of us, the places in which we struggle most as children can, if we use them as opportunities, turn into our purpose in life later on, or the strengths that we bring to bear. So in my case, the four in the middle of this group of six were the real clan. They were on the inside. So the four of them were very much together. They played together. I didn't actually get to practice as much the skills of nuance and of how to fit in, because I wasn't in. What that did was to drive me toward connection wherever I could make it. And what I discovered was that if I was willing to share a story that was personal and where I rendered myself vulnerable, 9 times out of 10, the person I was speaking to, whether they were the maid working in the house or a head of state I happened to be sitting next to at a dinner party of my parents, if I shared my soul, they would share theirs. And this was so thrilling to me. And actually, it was more than thrilling. It was essential for me to feel I belonged somewhere. And so that's what has driven me to the fields of social and emotional learning, of mind-body healing, and to connecting to people through my book, which has been one of the richest experiences of my life.
And that's exactly where I'd like to go next. You really gravitated towards the concept of emotional intelligence, maybe earlier than most people, before it was kind of a commonly known or understood phrase. And you've also devoted yourself really to encouraging research into mind-body work. And I'd like you to describe both of those fields and the support you've given to them.
May I take them in the order that I did them?
Of course.
Okay. Well, I first became interested in the mind-body relationship through my mentor, Norman Cousins. He had just written a book which became his best-selling book, a best-selling book for over a year in the New York Times list, which was Anatomy of an Illness. And it was about the healing that he found of a life-threatening illness through laughter and vitamin C. Well, I became intrigued by that because I remembered back to the days when I would get a headache every Wednesday when the substitute nanny would come and take care of me in the afternoon, and I really didn't like her, so much so that I would get a headache. And I couldn't wait till my mother would come home. She always would offer me a cup of tea, and there's nothing so soothing as a mother's attention and a good cup of tea, and my headache would go away. So I already knew firsthand the connection between mind and body. And when Norman shared his book with me, I thought, wow, this is something that really needs to get out there, because he was being torn down by the medical professionals, medical establishment. But I guess I knew enough to know that you can't build a whole institute around just one person, because the strength is in the community. So I was fortunate in being a member of my family where I really do have access to almost anyone. And I would get on the phone and be able to get a meeting. So my first meeting was with Joshua Lederberg, who was then president of Rockefeller University. I wanted to test the waters with him because I knew that he was a skeptic. He was also a very highly acclaimed scientist and a Nobel Prize winner for science. And what he said was exactly what I expected. How he said it was quite different. After I finished telling him my idea, he said to me, well, why don't you try something in real science? And so I took a deep breath and I said, well, using all my feminine wiles, just in case I should be so foolish as to persist, could you tell me who might you respect who could get involved in this field, should they get involved in this field? So he scratched his chin and rubbed his paunch and told me that if I got Lewis Thomas, the chairman of Memorial Sloan Kettering, and Neil Miller, who founded biofeedback at Rockefeller University, or Jimmy Holland, who was the chair of and chief of psychiatry at Memorial Sloan Kettering, if you got any one of them, I would take it more seriously. Well, that's all I needed. I thanked him very much and went out with a gleam in my eye. And within the next few weeks, I had appointments with each of the others, said to each of them, Dr. Lederberg says that if you joined the Science Advisory Board of the Institute for the Advancement of Health, he would start to take this subject more seriously. And furthermore, if you join, I know that the other two will join. Of course, I really didn't, but they all did. And so I got all three of them on board and many others besides, including people like Dean Ornish, who's, I think, globally famous now for his work in reversing heart disease. And we, the Institute for the Advancement of Health, gave him his first grant. So that was exciting in and of itself. The point here, though, was that it was bringing together a broad spectrum of a community of people who were all mavericks in their own specific field under the umbrella of what has now become accepted as mind-body health. And it was through the collective wisdom of all of them that we helped to create the field of mind-body health. So that was organization number one that I helped to found. And 3 years into it, I had my children, two sons, and by the seventh year, I became exactly what I said would happen if you didn't have the balance between mind and body. And I became quite sick. I had bilateral mid-ear infections. My brother Richard was the one who diagnosed me and said, you know, I think you have some kind of pneumonia and you better rest. And it gave me the pause I needed to make the choice that every woman who has children needs to make at some point or another. And that is, which comes first? How do I how do I juggle my job and my role as a mother? I was in the fortunate position of being able to become a full-time mother. And I am very glad I made that choice. And also that I was able to pass the Institute on into the hands of the three major foundations who supported us. So the work of the Institute is still going today in Washington, D.C. And within a couple of years, I still couldn't pass up doing something on the outer world, but I wanted it to have, I wanted it to be closer to home, closer to my own heart, and closer to my children. And I had a perfect laboratory right in front of me because my kids, as any two kids, were having arguments. And so the day that I came home from an education conference where someone had given me a red stuffed heart, it was stuffed with seeds and felt very good kinesthetically, and had said that they used this heart for mediation with their third graders. And they told me what they did. So I walked through the door, and my older son comes up to me, "Mommy, Mommy, Danny bit me today. And look." And then he shows me a relatively small red mark on his arm. But instead of taking a side or making assumptions, which is so easy to do as a mother, especially if you're in the hurry to get dinner on the table or get them to bed, I said, "Well, I've got just the thing. And come on upstairs." I mean, of course, I gave him some sympathy first for the red spot, but I said, "Let's see if we can work this out." So I brought Adam and Danny to these cushions, and I showed them the red heart, and Paul was there with me, and I told them the rules. I said, "Whoever's holding the heart is the only one talking, and I want you to tell each other what you didn't like, how it made you feel, and what you would have preferred." So Adam spoke to his younger brother and said, "Danny, I didn't like it when you bit me today. I was scared and it hurt." And then he thought for a moment and said, "Next time, I would prefer you scream." Well, no parent would have ever opted for that or suggested, "Why don't you just scream instead?" I mean, it was so age appropriate. And so then we handed the heart to Danny, trying to smother our laughter. And Danny was only two, Adam was four. And Danny said, "Adam, I didn't like when you pushed me off Spring Horse." Always two sides to the problem. He said, "I was angry and scared." And then he paused and he said, "Adam, I'm sorry I bit you. Next time, I will scream loud." And he did from there on and never bit him again. So we've actually, I've developed hearts. And if anybody's interested in the talking heart, I have it on my website. And you can look into it. And there's a chapter in the book called Heart Talks. So this is a very long-winded way of saying that I had a lot of personal interest in emotional intelligence. And around this time, Daniel Goleman also decided to investigate the field. He actually came out to California and asked me what I thought was going to be the next field after mind-body health. And I said, "I think it's going to be emotional literacy." It's been called since emotional intelligence. He wrote the book under such name, which has become a bestseller. So I have a pattern going with a best-selling writer and an organization that gets established. And out of Dan's research, I created with a group of other people, not by myself, the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. Its acronym is CASEL, C-A-S-E-L, and it's housed at the University of Illinois in Chicago. And our purpose is to help school children, pre-K through 12th grade, to acquire the skills that we might have called life skills some years ago. They're the kinds of skills that keep you in a job, that help you navigate your way on the playground, that help you make good choices when you're in high school and college, and that help you to be an effective citizen. I'm very grateful and humbled to have been part of this organization. And it's still going strong today.
We're talking with Eileen Rockefeller. Her memoir is Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself. What do you suppose it was that initially attracted you to the entire field of emotional literacy, as you called it then, or what's been come to be known as emotional intelligence?
Well, it goes back to the feeling of being excluded in my family. And, you know, I really hold no blame to my siblings today. We get along so well. We've worked so hard to get along. But as to why I'm interested in emotional intelligence, emotions were not allowed growing up in the 50s. You weren't supposed to express them. But I watched each of my siblings try a different technique, whether it was withdrawal, or sulking, or anger, or intellectual isolation, any number of techniques. And none of them really seem to get what they needed with regards to my mother's or father's attention. So I chose being emotional. And it's not so much that it got more attention. I guess it did get more attention, actually, than what my siblings got. It got a different kind of attention. It wasn't really what I needed, but it helped me to survive, and it kept me close to my mother. I took care of her needs growing up. She was severely depressed at times, and my job seemed to be the caregiver, and that developed emotional skills. I had to develop real intuition, because if she walked in the door and I hadn't gotten it, that she was in a really black cloud mood, I would be asking for something. And I wanted to avoid that. So in a strange, ironic way, her depression and propensity for anger or outbursts and my siblings sort of ignoring me or pushing me away helped to hone my own emotional skills.
We've talked about your mind-body work and also your work on emotional intelligence, but conservation is a theme that is present in your life from the very beginning. And you tell a story in the book about being a teenager and first having an experience with environmentalism and conservation when you became aware of pollution in the Hudson River.
Yes.
And being who you were, you had the opportunity to ask your uncle, the governor, to come down and take a look at the pollution in the river and do something about it.
Yeah.
But talk about how conservation really grew into a life's passion for you.
Well, there's an underlying theme to conservation. And I think that's the appreciation of beauty, whether it's natural or human-made. And the appreciation of beauty has probably been the greatest unifier in my family of origin and in my extended family. It runs throughout all of us, the conservation of beauty, the conservation of nature, which is probably the greatest resource for restoration of the soul. And so in that light, my husband and I moved back to Vermont, I became aware that there were several organizations working in the subject of sprawl, of urban sprawl. So I helped to convene a conference of all of the Vermont-based organizations interested in or involved directly in sprawl. And out of that grew a collaboration. And then a few years later, Paul and I got very specific because we often drove down to Middlebury from Shelburne. And somehow we became aware that a parcel of land here and a parcel of land there had for sale signs on them. And we thought, boy, if we don't do something about this, this whole historic road with views that could match and any national park will be destroyed. And so our objective was to preserve land outside the bookends of each of the towns existing on Route 7 between Shelburne and Middlebury. We put together a board of very dedicated citizens and this small nonprofit called the Champlain Valley Greenbelt Alliance, and we hired Kate Lampton, who'd been a very widely respected and highly skilled town planner for the town of Shelburne. And she had just the right skills as the leader, which is probably the most important thing you can do in any organization you want to start, is finding the right leader. So she had a way of not ruffling anybody's feathers, yet finding out information and bringing the right people together and making the right matches between either the Vermont Land Trust or the Charlotte Land Trust, or on down through the corridor. And we were able to purchase and re-gift properties with the development rights, meaning to save them from being developed, but the property owners would get the same amount of money. And we did that for all of the key properties between Shelburne and Middlebury. So forevermore, unless they change the laws, the beautiful views you see as you go down, which can absolutely parallel the great views from Acadia or Yosemite or Yellowstone, but you don't pay for it, will be there. And that was very satisfying.
You've become very interested in the topic of global warming.
Yes.
And that might strike some people as seeming ironic, given your family's early history running an oil company that was very powerful. Talk a little bit about how you see that juxtaposition.
Well, again, it's all about balance. My great-grandfather was interested in oil, but I should say here that his original reason was for a conservation purpose, and I don't think enough people know this. He got interested in oil because whales were becoming extinct, and they were using whale oil for lamps and for electricity, for lighting. So he was searching for some alternative and came across oil, and then he built his empire on that. I think that if my great-grandfather had seen or could have foreseen what would happen to the earth with the amount of carbon output as a result of cars that are fueled by oil, by gas, I don't know what he would have done then, but I know he'd be turning in his grave today, because he too took such solace from nature and really revered it. As much as he was a Northern Baptist and believed in the Bible and in the Word of God, and felt that God had actually intended for him to make this money so he could do something good in the world, he never, I'm sure, anticipated that it would have the ramifications it's had today for global warming. In 2007, my husband and I decided to combine our philanthropy. We spent 6 months investigating all of the dreams we'd ever had. How could we make a difference in the world? And with a relatively small amount of money, what could we do that could actually make a difference? Ultimately, it came down to, no matter what we chose, everything hinged on whether or not we're going to have a climate that we can actually live healthily in. So what is impinging on that healthy climate? CO2 emissions. And what is the greatest culprit of all CO2 emissions? 40% of all CO2 is generated from coal. There were, at that point, in 2007, 200 new proposed coal-fired power plants. Each one of those would last 50 years. Each one of those would put out into the atmosphere the equivalent of 100,000 new cars. So our job was, we decided, would be to try to stop them from ever being built. That's where we could find leverage. It was a venture capital model, in a way, venture philanthropy. Simultaneous to our interest, we discovered that the Sierra Club was eager to start their Beyond Coal campaign, but they had not been successful in their fundraising efforts. So we gave them their first major grant of $150,000. That was a big grant for us. We were the catalytic grant, but others came in after us. And we also insisted that they create a business plan. We wanted to have measurable results. It wasn't just enough to create a feel-good grant. Well, to make a long story short, 172 of those 200 proposed coal plants have been stopped. will never be created. And the others are rapidly falling by the wayside. And in addition to that, where there was no funding going to stop coal back in those days, there's $90 million going to stop coal in this country now, and it's going into the existing plants and the export terminals as well. So it's a pretty exciting story, and an ironic one, because I've always been for something. And this is the first philanthropic cause where I'm actually against something. It doesn't sort of fit my nature, but I'm against something because I'm for something. I'm for the beauty that should be a natural right to each of us, and I'm for the opportunity for everyone to walk in the woods and breathe healthy, pure air, and I'm for the right for people to have good health, and for us to have assured that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren will grow up in a healthy world.
You write a lot about nature and the outdoors really kind of sustaining your spiritual life.
Yes.
And you also have a pretty interesting religious journey. You talk about how you were the first person in your Protestant family to marry a Jew. And I'd like you to talk about how you've woven your religious life together.
It's been a really interesting path, and not always an easy one. It would have been easier for Paul had he married a Jewish woman, because I wouldn't have been protesting to some of his desires, and it might have been easier for me. But our love was able to bridge a lot of that, and I think what we've ended up doing as parents has been a model for marrying all kinds of disparities and differences, which comes back around to emotional intelligence and the need for that in any relationship, whether it's a marriage or something else. So I like to say I expanded to Judaism. I went through a conversion process, but I never felt converted. I don't even like that term. I don't like people telling me what to do or how to do it. I much prefer an invitation. One thing is, I really love a lot of the rituals that we did in our home, like the Friday night Shabbat, where we take the time to light candles and say blessings over the wine and the bread and come together as a family. I love that Paul would always give a blessing to our boys with his hands on the top of their heads. And to this day, they still squat down on either side of him as if they're still little boys. And then he does a blessing for me. It's from Proverbs 31, I think it is. And there is one point at which the blessing says, "And her children rise up and call her blessed." And at a certain point, when they were about 6 and 8, still able to put me on a pedestal and think that I could do no wrong, they both stood up, to my amazement, as he said that. And then it says, and her husband also. And so he stands up. And, you know, it's a very simple thing, but it's so touching. I think it's touching because we're simply taking the time to mark the moment, this sacred moment of our being together at the end of the work week, at the beginning of the weekend. And frankly, I don't care what religion it is. I think the value of religion is to invite us into the pauses that create a still place inside ourselves, so that we become more than our everyday humdrum and our worries, but actually fall into the fullness of ourselves with each other. And if a religion can do that, that's just wonderful.
How did your upbringing influence the way you raised your sons?
Well, my mother was quite rebellious about church. She didn't want to have to wear a hat, and in those days you did. And she felt she'd lost her voice, so she really wanted to stop going to church early on. Therefore, I inherited a certain rebellious spirit. And I can't say that I was much better when it came time to having our children go to Sunday school and prepare for their bar mitzvahs. It all just seemed too much. But I was ultimately so proud of them. Growing up, there may not have been as many religious rituals in my family of origin, but there were other rituals that were similar to that pause I was talking about. For example, anytime my family, all my siblings got together, my father would be so happy. Now, he didn't spend much time with us when we were growing up because he was out building the Chase Manhattan Bank and going all over the world. And I think it's something he still regrets to this day, but he's lived long enough to be able to make up for it in spades, which is so nice. And the thing is, he would always make a toast. He would stand up and he'd have his glass of wine and say, "I just would like to say how good it is to have the whole family together." Well, you hear that enough times, and it begins to seep into your bones that this is something good. This is a value. And what is religion about then? About helping instill values and helping us think about what is a right life, what is a good life, and how do we live the good life in harmony together?
Your grandfather set your family on a course of putting philanthropy at the center of the work your family does. How has that lived on through generations?
It's lived on through the generations as a common value. But my cousin's generation has learned to create philanthropic collaboratives, because where we couldn't fund something like start the University of Chicago or found Rockefeller University or repair Versailles or even give the money for a whole national park, what we could do was we could work together. And we could preserve maybe a smaller piece of land, or we could create an organization to develop collaborative thinking. So my generation has done collaborative philanthropy, and I'm watching our sons now and their generation, and they have such creative ways of thinking about philanthropy, and they're thinking about it much more in terms of venture philanthropy, the way we're doing Grow Old Family Fund. I think we're going to see a shift from having to just earn income year in and year out by fundraising. I think that nonprofits are going to have an income-producing arm to them in order to survive. There's too much competition out there, because everybody in the world who has an interest in creating change wants to start their own organization. And 9 times out of 10, they don't check to see whether there already are 5 other organizations doing that. But they're sure they can do it better, and so they're competing for the same money. So my children's generation are looking for more innovative and business-based models to implant into the philanthropic field.
You are the 4th generation of Rockefellers, and we've heard you in this conversation refer to the cousins' generation. And your father, David, is now 99.
Yes.
He is the patriarch of the family. Mm-hmm. He's the last surviving member of his generation. How do you maintain the traditions of the Rockefeller family?
I think the best way that that gets passed down is by getting together and by staying in touch with each other and formalizing the ways that we gather and the place that we gather, so as to continue the personal relationships that make us want to continue to be together. And so we have family weekends twice a year, and we usually always meet at what has become the family estate. When my father dies, it will belong to the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, but we'll still have access to what's known as the Playhouse, which is a kind of Tudor-style mansion that my grandfather built for his children and grandchildren for just this kind of thing. And so in addition to regular business meetings, which are somewhat of a snore, we have livened them up with smaller group meetings around topics of mutual interest. Sometimes it's just about, you know, parenting. Other times it's a meeting for, there'll be a small subgroup meeting for in-laws. Then there are some traditions we've developed. There's a luncheon around the Christmas holidays with the extended family, which is probably the most popular thing we do. And we have now 250 members of the family, including spouses, about 150 without them. And we get easily 100, 120 people at these lunches. So you have to talk quickly if you want to talk to a lot of people. But then for a more relaxed conversation during the course of the weekends, we have something called the intergenerational dialogue. And it's extremely powerful. It's one of my favorite rituals that the family does. There's also something called the passages ceremony, which is an outgrowth of hearing too much backpatting by my uncles towards each other for having been elected governor for another term. Or we just decided it was important to honor each other as human beings. And so we do that through the convenient vehicle of our birthdays. And it's an opportunity if someone wishes to be presented, and it's always a choice, to say everything from, you know, their 11-year-old read 100 books this year, or, you name it, whatever personal accolades they wish to give. Hmm. It's also a chance to stand in a circle and honor those who've gone before, and we sing Amazing Grace together.
Hmm. And that's particularly poignant for you right now because yes. you are marking the passing of your brother just yes. recently.
Yeah, Richard Rockefeller was an extraordinary human being, and I think he lived as close to his potential as anybody I know.
Eileen, what do you hope people will take away from reading your memoir?
What I hope they'll take away from it is that it really, that the amount of money you have, while we all need a certain amount of money to have a roof over our heads and have enough food, that the real richness of life comes in our relationships with each other, and in the capacity to become ourselves as fully as possible. I think it's in becoming ourselves that we discover true meaning in our lives. And if we've discovered meaning, we have really happy, satisfied lives. And it matters far less whether we've become famous or rich, but the richness lies within.
I want to thank you so much for sharing so freely of your personal history with us. I appreciate your time.
You're most welcome. Thank you for asking such great questions.